Right, I think we'll begin. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 38th Malinowski Memorial Lecture. As most of you will know, this lecture commemorates the life and work of Bronislaw Malinowski, who was the Professor of Anthropology in the LSE from 1927 to 1942, and the founder of modern social anthropology in this country. The Malinowski Lecturer has always been elected by members of the department from amongst those who are, as we like to think, nearer the beginning of their career than their end. As you know, many distinguished lecturers are very distinguished, but are very close to retirement when they finally achieve the honour. And somebody who has already achieved a considerable amount, but from whom we expect a great deal more in the future. And Pascal Boyer is somebody who clearly fits this bill admirably. Pascal was educated in the University of Nanterre and took his doctorate in 1983 based on his fieldwork on the Fang and their oral literature in Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea. From 1986 to 1993, he was a research fellow in King's College, Cambridge, and he has also worked for a year at the Center for the Advanced Study in the Social Sciences in Stanford. Since 1993, he has worked in Lyon for the CNRS at the Institute of Cognitive Sciences. And for many years now, he has been working on aspects of, in the cognitive research field. He did his first period of research really on the memory and transmission of religious concepts, and now he's concerned primarily with cognitive and experimental research on cultural categories. He's already published several books, one stemming in French from his fieldwork, Barricade mystérieuse et piège à penser, analyse du mauvais écang, which he tells me means the traditional ethic of Cameroon. And then in English, Tradition as Truth and Communication, a cognitive description of traditional discourse, Cambridge University Press, 1990, and The Naturalness of Religious Ideas, A Cognitive Theory of Religion, University of California Press, 1994. Today's lecture is entitled Functional Origins of Religious Concepts, and it will be about his current research in the cognitive field, and with this distinctly Malinowskian ring to his title, we shall see how much of the Malinowskian agenda he is still going to continue. Pascal.
Thank you. Thanks. Well, I have now 55 to solve a very big question, well, to address a very big question, which is, what is the origin of religious concepts? And how come we find in all sorts of places the world over religious concepts with very similar recurrent features? That's a bit of a tall order, but I try to show that things have changed, and these used to be big mysteries for the social sciences, and now they've become what Chomsky calls problems. You know, mysteries, we don't know where to go. Problems, they're problematic, but we know where to go. So that's what I try to show. Now, the reason why these things have become problems instead of mysteries is that there's been an awful lot of progress in our understanding of how minds work and how brain structures make minds receptive to certain kinds of concepts, certain kinds of representations. The idea that I will not try to defend in this lecture, because I take it for, well, I don't take it for granted, but I take it as read, is that the aggregated results of individual processes of acquisition have this effect that they produce cultural recurrence, that is, stability over time and stability between groups. So what we find easily transmittable is also what we find in many places. Now, in this kind of account of cultural concepts, what we have to understand is that cultural representations are just the occurrence of roughly is the important word, similar representations in a group. Another thing that's very important for this account is that there is no such thing as downloading information between brains. There's no such thing as understanding what people mean by just having a direct transfer of thought. What you have to have is communication. Communication creates inferences. Inferences create distortion. Distortion creates cultural variance. There's no such thing as transmitting culture, actually. There's only one process, which is building concepts out of cultural input, which creates enormous numbers of variants of concepts. But then sometimes there are recurrent features, and that's what we have to explain. So what I call functional origins of religion is not some mysterious event that happened like 100,000 years ago or 50,000 years ago. It's something that happens all the time, at all times, in all human minds. And that creates lots of different possible variants of concepts. It creates fewer concepts that are roughly similar in a group. That's what I mean by functional origins. I'll try to tell you about two different selection processes that happen in human cultures, which I think produce what we observe as religious concepts. First, there is a kind of selection from imagination in general to what I call culturally successful supernatural imagination. That is, concepts of supernatural stuff that are particularly likely to be well transmitted in human groups. That's what I call conceptual selection of cultural concepts, which creates cultural ideas of supernatural stuff around that has good cultural fitness. That is, it's likely to be transmitted in groups. But there's another process that, out of a subset of that supernatural imagination, creates what we call religious agency. So there are two processes here. And basically, the lesson from this lecture is that, what I like to convey is that this is fairly well understood. This is a bit more difficult, but we know where to go. So basically, it's a kind of upbeat message, an upbeat and positivistic message, if you want. Things are taken care of by scientific research. Okay. In order to understand why certain kinds of supernatural imagination are culturally successful, what you have to do is consider a set of concepts that are called ontological categories and intuitive ontological processes. There are things that work in our minds all the time, without being consciously accessible, but things, little specialized procedures that produce descriptions of different kinds of objects in the world and make us expect certain kinds of properties from certain kinds of objects. For example, we know that from infancy, there are very different kinds of objects in the world, like persons, animals, this is funny, this print, artifacts, plants is a kind of weird category that doesn't occur very early, and what I call natural objects, that is, things like rocks and rivers in the environment that are things that are there but are not live. Okay. We also know that there are things, the processes in the mind that very often require dedicated brain structures that track particular aspects of these things in the world. For example, lots of psychologists study intuitive physics. Intuitive physics is just the kind of process that predicts the trajectories, the interaction of solid objects in the environment. Like, for example, the expectation that if I drop this, it won't stay up in the air or it won't go sideways. Number and object constancy are another process that we see from infancy research, that is, something that tracks the properties of solid objects as being one object or two objects and having properties of number. Biological essentialism is a kind of thing that it seems also has dedicated brain structures that produce inferences about live things as being driven by some internal source of energy. Structure and function teleology is not important for this purpose. Intuitive psychology is another such process. That is, again, it's a dedicated brain structure that keeps track of the behavior of animate things in the environment as being caused by internal states of those things that are mental representations that spontaneously applied to animals and people in the environment automatically. What we get from these systems is not any we have no conscious access to how these systems operate or what their principles are. What we get is the output. That is, we see an object and we can predict its trajectory if it's, you know, dropped at a certain angle. We see people and we immediately have some representation of what their representation is supposed to be. Okay. Now, what's that got to do with religion? When you study these intuitive ontological principles, there's one thing you're bound to notice if you're interested in religious concepts, which is that most religious concepts are about a special kind of something that belongs to one of these categories, and a special kind for which people represent some information that violates what psychologists would tell you are these spontaneous inferences and expectations that people make about that category. I have two examples of religious concepts that are really generic concepts that everyone should have some knowledge of. Like a spirit. A spirit is a kind of person. But a spirit is also a special kind of person because very often, for example, it violates physical expectations. We all have spontaneous physical expectations about agents, which is that they are embodied. They're in solid objects, which means that it's if I managed by some trick to go right through this overhead projector, I'm sure you'd remember that event. I mean, you know, it would be striking. Okay. But unfortunately, I can't demonstrate that tonight. So you create a special kind of object, and it invariably violates information that we know from psychological research is represented as a spontaneous expectation about that kind of object. Another thing that you find in these religious concepts is that all the expectations about certain ontological category that are not violated are preserved. They're actually used. And again, taking the example of a spirit is a very strange kind of person, if you want, in the sense that it has counterintuitive physical properties, can go through objects and stuff like that. But in a tacit way, that is, without ever representing that explicitly, people invariably think that spirits have minds, and they have minds that work according to all the principles of intuitive theory of mind. For example, it's always tacitly assumed that spirits perceive events that happen because those events happen, that they have beliefs because of their perceptions, that they have intentions because of their beliefs, and not the other way around. Okay, so there's an intuitive psychology that's spontaneously applied to these things. And I think it's not because there's cultural theory that spirits have minds. It's just that there is a spontaneous expectation that anything that's in the category person has a mind, and that's the way it works. Now, when you study religious concepts in that way, you have to remember two things. One is that people are not theologically correct. That is, you can't predict what people's concepts would be like by just studying the local official theory of what those concepts should be like. But that's rather familiar to anthropologists, of course. Another one that's less familiar to anthropologists, maybe, is that people have, in general, very little access to the principles that structure their own concepts. That is, people don't think the way they think, okay? For example, if you take those principles of intuitive physics, there are principles that say what the trajectory of solid objects in the world is. No one's really aware of what those principles are, but you're aware of the output of these principles. You can predict where the tennis ball will go, okay? Right, if we see religious concepts in that way, what we end up doing is describing them in terms of more abstract templates that they represent. Templates are ways of activating information from intuitive ontology. And generally, a religious concept will have this kind of structure. It's got a lexical label, but that's not terribly important. It's got an ontological category that's activated. That ontological category has lots of inferences, like, you know, if it's a person, it's got a certain position in space. It's got mental representations. It's got certain intentions, things like that. But there's a violation of one of those, or several of those inferences, okay? This is what the squiggle is supposed to show. But all the others are preserved. And then you have some additional encyclopedic detail that doesn't do much. The idea is that the transmission of those concepts depends on those templates. Those templates are ways of activating knowledge that is already represented in people's minds by virtue of having a normal brain. And concepts that activate intuitive knowledge in this way have a good chance of being culturally transmitted. Very quickly, here's an example of the ghost concept again, where you have all sorts of inferences from the person category, like, you know, if it's a person, it forms intentions, that it has certain goals. It has memories. That is, if something happened, it perceived it, then it remembers that it happened. It perceives events and stuff like that. But also is a solid object. And this one is crossed out. But all the others are transferred. And that explains enough about the inferences that people produce on those concepts to be a reasonably good approximation of what happens when people represent such concepts. Now, if you do that, and you say, like I say, these concepts are culturally successful, you have to do two things. One is to show that most religious concepts are of that format. And that's what I did in one of these books. But that's all right. But then you have to explain why it should be the case that concepts of that format are culturally successful. You know, what sort of advantage does it give, you know, in terms of transmission, that these things should constitute a sort of domain of culturally successful imagination? And that's where we get to experimental research. There's no other way to show that than to do experiments. The idea being that if we have a list of templates like that, and that those templates are things we find in all, in the anthropological record, there's examples of the supernatural imagination in very different cultures, then there might be something in individual processes of acquisition and transmission that would make such concepts much, well, better than others, better enough that the individual processes of acquisition and transmission would give those concepts an edge, and that edge being aggregated over many, many cycles of transmission would make them culturally successful. So for a number of years now, I've been testing these things by using experimental methods. Here's an example of one of these things. Testing a very simple difference between violations of ontological expectations and standard associations, and using free recall tasks, that is, we just give subjects stories where there are lots and lots of things happening, enough to saturate memory. Those things that happen combine violations of intuitive expectations, like, for example, a table that listens to what you're saying, or a person who disappears if you turn on the light, or, you know, that sort of thing. And standard associations, that is, table made of wood, or stuff like that. And what we find, I mean, I included the columns just to show that when I said a positivist model, I wasn't joking. This is the real thing. What we find is that we find much better recall for these gray columns, that is, for things that include variations of intuitive expectations, than for the rest. This is just one of the many replications we did of that kind of stuff. That is, people recall that stuff better than standard associations. So that stuff has a certain advantage in terms of individual memory. Now, you could say, well, this is trivial, like most cognitive psychology, and indeed it is, but there is something to that thing, which is that you may think, well, this is just a question of these things being unfamiliar. You know, they're not the usual stuff. So a table made of wood is the usual stuff, but a table that listens to what you're saying is not the usual stuff. So we said, well, if the model has any virtue, it should rule this out, because then, you know, otherwise it would be totally trivial. So what we did was to have stories in which we used three levels of properties. One was what we call OK sentences. That is just a table that's made of wood. And then we explain a bit more about this table made of wood. Then we use what we call basic level violations. Basic level violations are things that are not ontological violations, but are very unfamiliar, like a table made of chocolate. And then counterintuitive was our term for violations that are violations of ontological knowledge, like a table that listens to people, a table that's feeling sad, that sort of thing. And we had that for artifacts and for persons. Justin Barrett at Cornell University tested some of that stuff, and I did the rest. And what we find is that there is a significant difference between the ontological violations and the odd stuff, like the tables made of chocolate. In other words, the huge advantage that you get from violations of ontological expectations is not just a question of these things being unfamiliar or odd. Okay, it's also a function of these things violating certain kinds of knowledge. But then you could say that, okay, but the ontological violations are really bizarre. They're really extremely strange. And maybe that's what drives recall. And that would be bad news for the model, too, because if it's just a question of being extremely unfamiliar or extremely weird, then that would make the explanation a bit trivial. So what we did was to try and test what happens if you take those templates where you have a violation of intuitive ontological expectations, and you make it such that you can't have the preserved inferences from the ontological category. For example, if I have spirit concept, it's got its physical properties that are kind of weird or counterintuitive, but then it's got its mental properties that are okay, and I can produce lots of inferences on that basis. So we had stories where we had extremely strange concepts for example, spirits that are immaterial, but also remember only things that didn't happen or have very weird mental functioning, so that they're, in a way, combinations of zombies and spirits, okay? They have, and we had a whole variety of these concepts. And what we find is that if you make the bizarreness of these things extreme in that way, what you find is that recall decreases. That is, you don't get better recall. There's a sort of optimal level. That optimal level is exactly what we find in religious concepts and supernatural concepts in general. What you find in, what you get if you use material that's much more bizarre than that is less recall rather than more. So it's not a question of these things being unfamiliar. It's not a question of these things being extremely bizarre. It's just a question of them violating some very specific aspects of ontological knowledge that is tacitly represented in the mind. Now, at that point, doing all that kind of work, if you were trained as an anthropologist, you start thinking, well, it's all very well, but most psychology is about the American middle class and the European middle class by extension, and that's a very interesting culture. But it's only one. It's not terribly impressive in terms of cross-cultural validity. So what I did was to try and replicate that kind of study in other places, and going back to Cameroon, because that's my field, I went there and did a whole series of studies on memory for that kind of stuff. What was very difficult was to find items such that they wouldn't be intuitively associated with religious stuff by people. That is, the idea was to make it culturally neutral or kind of exotic, things that people never heard, never encountered in their cultural sort of input so far, and test the same kind of stuff. So what we did was the same kind of stories where we have all sorts of things and we test in a bit like Bartlett used to do, how people recall these things and also how they transmit these things. And what we found was a very nice stepwise thing. Incidentally, it's not that easy to find that kind of effect in psychology. It's always good when it turns out that way. And it didn't turn out that way the first time. But we managed to calibrate the studies in such a way that we got that effect, which is that people remember the darker things, that is the counterintuitive things that have violation of intuitive ontology best. And then there's much lower recall in terms of statistical significance for basic level violations like tables made of chocolate, and there's even less for standard items, okay properties, okay? So it's kind of interesting that you get the same sensitivity to violations of intuitive ontological expectations, okay? Now, just to make this even more anthropological than it should be, really, I thought maybe this has to do with, if you want to find funny variables that could explain what you found, you could say, well, this could be because in both Cameroon and in French American subjects, what you have is the is a religion without a very heavy theology. That is, you have popular religion and nothing much apart from that. So just for the sake of it, I teamed up with Charles Ramble, specialist of Tibetan Buddhism, and we tried this in Kathmandu with both lay people who were around, mostly Tibetan refugees and Tibetan monks, because monks are real pros, you know, in producing lots of counterintuitive stuff. And it's, you know, and they're specialists. I mean, they're sort of, so we thought, well, maybe there are differences. You have to remember that, especially in that Bompo tradition we were working on, there's huge emphasis on changing the person and giving the person characteristics that are counterintuitive relative to the person category, like making a person such that they can realize that the world out there is not out there, is not real, okay? That it's an illusion. You have to put people in very strange cognitive states to get them to realize, to accept that truth. And people in that kind of tradition take that as a cognitive problem that can be solved by the appropriate cognitive techniques. I mean, like, you know, sensory deprivation or things like that, which are just techniques. But the point of these things is to change minds. Okay. So we thought, well, maybe these people will be more interested in the mind kind of violations, that is, people having funny minds, rather than the artifact kind of things where artifacts have strange properties. In fact, we found exactly the opposite, which is kind of puzzling, which is a kind of counter-cultural effect. That is, people were recalling more of the artifact items that we had rather than the person items, which is, I won't try and disguise the fact that it's kind of a puzzling effect. Remember, all these items were culturally unfamiliar. People never heard those stories. Okay? But in a way, there was some kind of saliency for stuff of a format that never heard. But I don't exactly know how to explain that, and I won't pretend that I have a way. But the important result is that we find the same sort of curve. There's massive advantage, and there's an interaction here. But there's a massive advantage for the counterintuitive stuff that violates ontological categories relative to both basic level violations and OK associations. Okay, so it's the same sensitivity in a way. If you think this is tedious, you should see the real experiments, because these are just the edited highlights. You know, I mean, it sounds like one after another, but the real thing is just calibrating stuff very finely until we get an effect that is really sensitive, because it's not a simple question at all. How many items out of a list of 32 or 64 can people remember, given their, you know, schooling, cultural traditions, and so on and so forth? This can change things a lot, and it doesn't change that kind of sensitivity, but it changes the parameters of the experiment. Okay? And we found that indeed, you know, as most anthropologists sort of know from anecdotal evidence, people who've done no schooling are much better at recalling lots of complicated stuff. Okay, so. So what this experimental evidence suggests is that, well, there is a sensitivity to counterintuitive. What I call counterintuitive really is violations of intuitive expectations. I don't mean strange, funny, far out, bizarre, or anything for the reasons I told you. What I mean is very specific. It's violating information spontaneously attached to ontological categories. We find that recall depends on background inferences. That is, if you block those background inferences, if you make, for example, if you make a spirit so funny that that spirit doesn't have a proper mind, then you make that spirit concept very difficult to recall. Okay, all this suggests that there's a sort of limited catalog of the supernatural imagination. And that's all because there isn't that much in intuitive ontology to violate. There isn't that much to preserve. In other words, there aren't that many combinations. Okay, my current catalog has about 15 items, but it doesn't matter whether it's 12 or 32. It's already depends how thin the slices are in the ontological cake. What matters is that there aren't that many of those. But still, in a way, there are too many, because this stuff is what we find in supernatural imagination. that is in religion, of course, but also in fiction, in dreams, in folklore, in superstition, what I call superstition. That's not a very sound anthropological category, but it's, you know what I'm talking about. But religion seems to be a bit special in that conceptual selection. That is, really, when we say religion, we mean something that's a polythetic kind of set, you know, a sort of family resemblance, where there are some associations between the supernatural imagination and other stuff, like potential commitment. That is, some people are really committed to the idea that these things describe real stuff. There's potential emotional effects that you don't find in other kinds of supernatural things. There's association with ritual, with morality, and with group identity. I'm not saying this is a definition of religion. I'm saying this is a polythetic set. And, you know, ever since Ronald Needham told us, we now know that we shouldn't try to, you shouldn't try and turn those polythetic sets into proper definitions. This is a family resemblance. In lots of places in the world, you'll find association between some supernatural concepts and some of these things, okay? Maybe not all of them. But what's interesting is, why do you find that association? Why is it the case that you have that? And I think there may be an answer in cognitive and evolutionary psychology. First, note that these associations are not found with all the concepts in our catalog of the supernatural. They're typically found in things like persons with physical violations, persons with biological violation, artifacts with transfers of theory of mind. That is, for example, a statue you can pray to. Okay. That is, then, that's supposed to have a mind that listens. Certainly not in the official theology in many cases, but at least in your intuitive presumptions, you're talking to someone who's listening. In all these cases, what you find that is usually associated with these strong and socially important kind of effects are concepts where intuitive psychology is activated. Intuitive psychology is, you know, just the name of that small, probably newly implemented mental structure that tracks mental representations in other objects in the environment, i.e. animate objects, animals, people. Okay, that theory of mind is something that seems to be activated by the concept that we find associated with these. Okay. Like, for example, you can have concepts, you know, supernatural concepts that have a violation by transferring biology to artifacts, like thinking of chairs that have blood circulation. Okay. But you don't find that associated with strong group identity, morality, emotional effects, and stuff like that. You find that in stories, you find that in dreams, maybe. You find that in superstition sometimes, but you don't find that really that often in what we call religion, which is this polythetic set. Why should that be the case? Well, I have a kind of speculative solution to that problem. And that requires that we consider a bit more seriously what parts, what special sort of mental mechanisms we have as a result of evolution by natural selection. In particular, we have a whole set of mental adaptations that stem from the fact that we evolved in a context, in natural conditions of evolution, that were natural conditions where the presence of other people we interact with was crucial. That is, you know, these points are a bit banal, but their consequences are not. Humans are especially dependent upon information about natural environments. That is, that's why some people say that the proper ecological niche for humans is the cognitive niche. That is, the niche constituted by lots of potential information about the environment. But humans are also extremely dependent, I won't have to argue that because that's very familiar, upon cooperation and coordination with other people, other agents. By virtue of being dependent upon information and cooperation, they're dependent upon information about other people's information about the environment. That is, you have not just to represent what's happening out there and what other people are up to, you have to know what people think is happening out there, okay, and what they know, what they intend, and so on and so forth. And also you have to engage in cooperation. Now, it seems that there are certain special features of human cognitive architecture that stem from this dependency upon upon cooperation, especially in small groups where people know each other. First, what's well known is the hypertrophy of social intelligence that is compared to other social species. The complexity of inferences that humans make about other people's plans, intentions, thoughts, and so on is vastly superior and more complex. This is a list that has no special order, but it's just a few things that highlight consequences of our adaptations for social interaction. You have emotional rewards for gossip. I mean, I know that gossip is not a sort of central topic for anthropologists usually, but it's, which is surprising because it's a central domain of social interaction in all human groups the world over. Okay. And there's big emotion invested in gossip, and against gossip also. A capacity to detect non-cooperators. That is, there now seems to be some evidence that there are very strong emotional effects that are created by detection of particular situations of, you know, where cheaters can invade your social interaction space. And there are certain experimental designs that show how people can produce very complex inferences when they're faced with a problem that is about cheating and cooperating. Problems that they fail to solve when the situations described are not about social cooperation. We also evolved the presence of difficult to fake signals. That is, there are signals of cooperation that are very difficult to fake, like emotional signals. I mean, we like to think that it's very easy to conceal your emotions and so on and so forth. And there's tons of research in social psychology that shows that it's not the case. There are all sorts of things that are very easy to detect for people. And lots of emotional signals are outside voluntary control. It's extremely difficult to lie successfully. It's not impossible, but it's very difficult. And very often people have an intuitive sense that they shouldn't trust certain people saying certain things, and they have no idea why, but there is a system in the brain that's keeping track of emotional cues and saying, okay. Self-deception is another mechanism that we know seems to be occurring because of this need for cooperation. That is, it's a mechanism whereby you find desirable some situations where, in cases where it would be desirable that other people found those things desirable. And I'll talk a bit more if I have time about that. Recently, quite a lot of experimental economists have been saying that moral feelings are evolved cognitive adaptations. That is, that we have moral feelings because they're a good thing to have. Not because they make us good. I mean, that's, you know, evolution is not terribly interested in that. But because in context of interaction with, in small groups, where there's going to be iterated interaction with people, maintaining a reputation is an essential asset. And there are very few ways of maintaining a good reputation for cooperation, for example, non-cheating, if you're not actually a cooperator. Also, it's very difficult to be a cooperator if you don't have feelings about cooperation, simply because self-interest in many circumstances would lead you to cheat. There are many, many opportunities where it's easy to cheat, you won't be detected, and so on and so forth. Now, the question is, how do you get a good reputation for being a non-cheater? Well, by one of the few ways is by being a non-cheater, not because you choose to be a non-cheater, but because you're pushed by something you can't help, like disgust at the idea of cheating. Okay? And there's an interesting literature about the fact that many of these moral feelings are actually very good adaptations. Now, when I said that all these are demonstrated experimentally, I mean, what I mean is that there's interesting and suggestive experimental evidence relevant to these things. I mean, you have to allow a bit of hyperbole every now and then. But what's interesting is that they're intuitive in their operation. That is, you don't compute the fact that a reputation for cheating or cooperating would be a good thing. You don't compute the fact that some people are just, in a creepy kind of way, people you can't trust. You just have a system that computes that. And you have the output, which is a feeling that certain situations are good for cooperation and others are bad. Okay. These things are not, and that's why people think they come from evolution, they're not easily derived from general intelligence. That is, if you had to go through a whole history, a whole lifetime of trying to see when people are reliable and when they're not, by the time you'd acquired that wisdom, you'd be long dead, and you'd be probably dead because other people had cheated. So there has to be some sort of initial bias that sort of pushes you towards some intuition of what's good and what's bad in social interaction. That's why evolutionary psychologists call these Darwinian algorithms. Okay. They're algorithmic in the sense that they're formula that happen in the cognitive system without you taking much notice, except that you get the input. Excuse me. Now, all this gives us a kind of description of what strategic information is. This is going to be the crucial notion. In any situation of social cooperation, there's lots of information that's available to all the agents concerned. There's some subset of that information that's relevant to cooperation, cheating, establishing coalitions, maintaining cooperation, maintaining reputation. That subset that's relevant to those mechanisms, that activates those mental mechanisms, is what I call strategic information. Now, the what makes things a bit complicated in the case of human beings is that there's no natural kind of strategic information. That is, anything out there could be strategic information. It all depends on what you know about the context. So, you know, maybe the fact that I have meat in my fridge is not terribly interesting to you. Okay, non-strategic. But imagine I just said that I was a vegetarian. Then it could become strategic because there's something about my reputation that's kind of funny. I'm claiming something, and you have evidence that I'm different. Or if you're very hungry, of course, that's a strategic bit of information for you. If you're not hungry, but you know that I'll try and dump that meat on you, that's strategic too for another reason. But you see, there's no easy way of sorting out what is going to be strategic from what is not. The only difference is that what is strategic information here is totally operational. It's whatever activates your specialized mental machinery that deals with social cooperation. Okay, I had a little test here, but I don't think we have. It was just to verify that, if you fail that test, that shows that you're human. So, but that's, I trust my intuitive ontology that, you know, I have enough cues that this is the case. So, okay, well then really the final point I want to make is that if you have this sort of idea that there is specialized mental machinery in the brain that pays attention to certain cues in the environment and certain mental states of other people, and this is about social cooperation, coalitions, trust, reliability, cheating, stuff like that, that whatever information is taken into these systems and activates the systems is what I call strategic information. Now, remember the question was, why is it the case that some supernatural concepts, imagined things, are associated with very important social effects like, you know, group identity or morality or stuff like that? And it seems to me the question is not phrased the right way. That is, what we used to think was that, well, there are those supernatural concepts like, you know, concept of spirits or gods and stuff like that. And then there are domains of social interaction like morality and group identity and ritual and stuff like that. And somehow people connect these things, so they make their rituals that have to do with the gods, or they make their group identity something that's connected with their supernatural commitments and so on. I think that's not the way it happens. I think what happens is that the connection with social interaction is there in the representation of those concepts itself. What I mean by that is, try and imagine a new question for, you know, if you're an anthropologist in the field, and okay, you're told that there are spirits and gods and stuff like that. And what I've described so far is a set of processes that make it possible for people to represent such things, you know, as agents that go around sort of floating through physical objects or stuff like that. But now, since these things have minds, you know, what do they think about? You know, what's on their mind? You know, what's on the spirit's mind? Or what do gods think about? Of course, that's kind of a strange question. And as you know, if you ask that kind of question in field situation, village, you know, now tell me, what do spirits think about? People will think this is really weird. And actually, I think this is an explanation of why they think that's weird. Okay, but remember, this is not about theologies. This is not about what the local theory officially says that gods think about. It's just about people's presumptions, what they have in mind about what aspects of information about the situation is going to be on a god's mind. Also, this is not really necessarily accessible to conscious inspection. I mean, this could be something that we have to test through experiments. And my hypothesis, that's my final point, I think, is that invariably, imagine religious agents, that is, those supernatural things that are around, are always presumed to have access to strategic information. Strategic information is whatever subset of the information about a situation is relevant to our evolved dispositions for social cooperation. I think it's plausible given the anthropological record, but we'll have to test that experimentally. I think that there's a tacit presumption for the socially important religious concept that these are about agents and that these agents have access to strategic information. That is, if you think about a situation and if you think there is a religious agent somewhere, you will tacitly assume that that agent has access to all the strategic information about the situation. I have two little illustrations for that, and they're very short. This is something I've actually studied experimentally. People who tell you, real believers, Christian believers, who tell you that God knows everything, okay? And when you ask them to go on about what God is like and stuff like that, they have a simple description, which is that whatever happens in the universe, God has a representation of it. Okay, God knows everything. And when you test them in things like story recall or inferences from stories and all that, you realize, I mean, if you manipulate the things a bit carefully, that what people in fact are assuming is that God has access to all the morally relevant aspects of situations. And the rest is kind of optional. But the rest is not the source of any inference. Also, another sort of very short illustration is that the number of scenarios you find where a religious agent has access to some information that human agents have no access to is, of course, vastly greater than the number of cases where human agents have access to some information that superhuman agents don't have access to. But then, in all the cases where it's the former, that is, the religious agent has access to some information that non-human agents have no access to, you'll find that in most of these stories, it's information that happens to be strategic to the human agent in question. Okay, so once we've done that, what we have is a sort of description of, you know, two selective processes. One is what makes culturally successful supernatural concepts out of individual imagination that can be incredibly varied. And that was that business of connections with ontology. Then you have another selection process, which is what makes it the case that some of those supernatural concepts are especially good for association with socially important domains like morality and ritual. And I think it's just because they are, in fact, tacitly assumed to have access to strategic information. Now, to conclude this, I want to say a word about the sort of state of the art now that we've done all this. As I said, Chomsky used to say that there were mysteries and problems, and I think mysteries are becoming problems in this domain. That is, supernatural imagination is really, well, when I say simple consequence, a consequence of the structure of intuitive ontology. But also that concepts of religious agents that we find are socially important, by which I mean mentally represented concepts of religious agents. It's not necessarily the case for theologies or for you know, literate doctrines and stuff like that. What I mean is mental representations of religious agents are selected by their association with strategic information. So questions of origins of religion, you know, where, you know, what's the origin of religion, are really empirical questions, because questions about intuitive ontology are questions of neuroscience, really. And questions of strategic information are supposedly easily dealt with in social psychology. Again, this is a very optimistic version of what's happening, but I think this is really what where things are going to go. And now, what is functional about this? You could say, well, it's kind of functional and it's also kind of functionalist, and indeed it is. And in a way, when I say that this is a functional origin, what I mean is that what we do when we describe mental processes is do a bit of reverse engineering. That is, we try and see what are those processes like in terms of what are they for? You know, what were they selected for? What do they do that would make it the case that they're transmitted by evolution, by natural selection? And talking about functional aspects or functionalism has had a bad press in anthropology for about 20 years, I think, or 30 or 40 or something. But, or maybe it's ever since Malinowski died or something. And the reason for that, we're told usually that functionalist, anthropological functionalists or functionalist anthropologists used to exaggerate a lot. They used to say that lots of aspects of cultural institutions are functional and can be explained by their functional aspects. And I think that's not the case. That's not the case first because it's very rare in anthropology that a paradigm is bad because it's pushed too far. If anything, paradigms in anthropology are usually so vague that they're not pushed at all, you know, for fear they might sort of disappear. And I think functionalism was not pushed far enough, and we should push it further in terms of explaining what the functional aspects in terms of evolution are for lots of mental capacities. And that would give us, I think, an explanation of lots of aspects of cultural institutions, including religious concepts. Thank you.
So, on behalf of you all, I'd like to thank Pascal Boyer for a tour de force of exposition. He's almost certainly right that we have spent far more time trashing functionalism than actually discussing it properly. And his attempt, at least, to persuade us that we should do so is probably something we're all going to have to think about considerably further. At this stage, however, we'll invite you all for a drink on the fifth floor of this building, where Pascal will probably not wish to discuss his lecture very much further, but we hope you will all come and join us anyway. Thank you very much.
Thank you.